Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program, very remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, October 7, 2020. Kenyan authorities have found two men guilty of masterminding terrorist attacks.
That's good news indeed. At last, we have managed to get justice for what we went through in 2013.
And more suspects are arrested in connection to the Rwandan genocide.
The prosecutor's office did not identify the suspects or give exact details of crimes they're accused of committing. What they have said is that the three are Rwandan and were living in Belgium.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A Kenyan court has found two men guilty for their roles in the deadly 2013 terrorist attack inside Nairobi's Westgate Mall. The men were convicted Wednesday of conspiring with and aiding the attackers from Somali militant Al-Shabaab group. The court acquitted a third suspect of all charges. Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Kenyan authorities arrested four men in 2013 for allegedly playing roles in the Westgate Mall attack. One was released in January 2019. The other three were in a Nairobi court Wednesday to listen to the verdict of Judge Francis Andai. Andai found Mohamed Abdi and Hussein Mustafa guilty, while Liban Abdullahi was acquitted due to lack of evidence.
In the final analysis, therefore, I find that the prosecution has not proved its case against the second accused person on all the charges that were facing him, and consequently he is acquitted under Section 215 of the Criminal Procedure Code. I am, however, satisfied that the prosecution has proved its case against the first and fourth accused persons on the respective charges facing them herein beyond a reasonable doubt. I find them guilty and convict them accordingly.
Gunmen stormed the busy mall one Saturday in September 2013 and opened fire, killing at least 67 people and injuring more than 150 others. Kenyan authorities said all four attackers were killed in the police and army siege that followed, although some analysts believe the gunmen escaped. The trial of the three men began in early 2019. The court listened to 40 witnesses as the men faced 12 accounts of terrorism-related charges. The judge found that Abdi and Mustafa supported and helped the gunmen who carried out the attack. The court also found the two men owned terrorism materials, knew about the attackers and communicated with the men who carried out the attack. 31-year-old John Wangombe, who worked at the mall, survived the attack. He welcomed the convictions.
That's good news indeed. At last, we have managed to get justice for what we went through in 2013. Although justice has been derailed, we have gotten justice at last.
Another survivor, 38-year-old Ben Mulwa, was in his vehicle when the gunmen attacked the mall. He abandoned his car, seeking safety, but came face-to-face with one of the attackers, who aimed a gun at him and fired. Miraculously, the gunmen missed. The father of four said Wednesday he is happy with the convictions.
We may never fully recover from either the injuries or the scars or even recover the lives that we lost, but I believe it is a good step in the right direction and also a consolation to a majority of those who survived the incident.
Mulwa says this conviction can help Kenyan youths who engage in terrorism to think about their future.
It is a very good step in the right direction because it shows commitment mostly from the part of the government to pursue justice. And I hope that especially our young people get excited into the radicalization by terrorist outfits, can see that this is a deterrent, and ultimately you may engage yourself in criminal activities that amount to nothing.
The judge will sentence the convicts later this month. The two men are facing jail time of up to 20 years. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Federal prosecutors in Belgium announced Tuesday the arrest of three people of Rwandan origin on international law violations related to the 1994 genocide when Rwanda's Hutu ethnic majority killed about 800,000 minority Tutsi and Hutu moderates in 100 days. The arrests come as survivors have demanded international justice, and Belgium, the former colonial power in Burundi and Congo, as well as Rwanda, seeks to do more to come in terms with its past. International Editions' Laurie Lodin gets details from Paris-based reporter Catherine Field.
The prosecutor's office did not identify the suspects or give exact details of crimes they're accused of committing. What they have said is that the three are Rwandan and were living in Belgium. Two were arrested in the capital, Brussels. The third in the southern province of Hainaut. They were taken into custody last week. On Monday of this week, a pre-trial court hearing confirmed their arrest. And it was only late on Tuesday that federal prosecutors released information confirming the investigation. And even then, saying only that the three men faced charges of serious violations of international humanitarian law committed during the Rwanda genocide. One of the men, though, has since been released on condition he wear an electronic ankle bracelet.
Will they face extradition to Rwanda, or, given the international arrest warrants, more likely face the International Criminal Court?
We know there was considerable cooperation between Belgian and Rwandan justice departments. Belgian prosecutors and investigators made several trips to Rwanda to interview witnesses. However, it isn't yet clear whether the three will be tried in Belgium or will be sent to Rwanda to face justice. You have to remember there have been a number of high-profile trials in Belgium of Rwandans accused of crimes committed during the genocide. Just last year, a Belgian court convicted a former Rwandan agricultural scientist for war crimes and sentenced him to 25 years in prison.
And Catherine, this, along with the recent arrest of Felicien Kabuga in Paris, must give survivors some sense of relief that they may actually see justice in their lifetimes, even if the wheels of justice move slowly. And did these arrests have any connection to Kabuga's, or is this a completely separate investigation?
Confirmation of these arrests comes just a week after a French court approved the extradition to a UN war crimes court of the alleged financier of the Rwandan genocide, Felicien Kabuga. We understand these arrests are not linked to that case. However, survivors are, of course, relieved that even after such a long period of time, these crimes are being investigated and those accused will face justice. But the question remains for them, why did it take so long, given that so many of these accused appeared on international wanted lists that were distributed to countries where it was known these fugitives had taken refuge?
South Sudanese young men and women's rights organizations are demanding for the establishment of a youth enterprise to help address unemployment across the country. Chapter 4 of the Revitalized Peace Agreement stipulated that an enterprise fund will be formed to help young South Sudanese. The parties to the agreement are yet to implement Chapter 4 of the agreement. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wood reports from Juba.
South Sudan's youth say they want the partners in the unity government to implement Chapter 4 effectively, and they want a say in how the youth fund is established. Christine Kide is national coordinator of the South Sudan Youth Organizations Coalition.
We all know that the youth are not so much engaged in the government formation. We have a limited number of young people that have been appointed to various positions. And at this point, we came down and discussed that our only incentive in the Revitalized Peace Agreement is the Youth Enterprise Development Fund. And we realized that it is high time we start demanding for the formation of this enterprise fund before it is forgotten.
2 years after the peace agreement was signed, partners in the unity government are still struggling to implement parts of chapters 1 and 2, which deal with the power sharing and security arrangements. Late last month, the United Nations envoy to South Sudan and UNMISS boss David Sierra described implementation of the agreement as stuck, saying almost no progress had been made in unifying the country's warring forces under one army as promised under the peace deal. He said troops brought together at joint training sites across the country were deserting because of a lack of food and other basic necessities. Youth leaders say it is from this backdrop that they fear politicians will forget about Chapter 4, which has to do with empowering young people. Again, Kristen Kide.
There has been no light shined into that direction. So we are coming up to inform our leaders that we know that they agreed to support us through the Youth Enterprise Fund. And we are asking them that the time is now. They should start engaging and establishing this platform for us to start organizing ourselves as young people so towards the process of nation building. We want to be at the center of the process.
The campaign to establish the Youth Enterprise Fund is being directed by a coalition of more than 25 youth rights organizations across the country. The coalition was founded in 2018 during the IGAD-mediated South Sudan peace talks, which led to the signing of the September 2018 revitalized peace agreement. Peter Malir Biar is the chairperson of the South Sudan Coalition of Youth Rights Organizations.
The Youth Enterprise Development Fund must develop diverse products, services for youth and promote skills development, capital provision, market linkages, employment connections, trade fairs, business expansions, and national youth services.
Malir says the youth fund will help empower vulnerable youth who are most often being used to propagate rebellion in parts of the country. The coalition is calling for quick reconstitution of the parliament as stipulated in the peace deal. Once that happens, Malir says the coalition expects the youth fund to be established with an act of parliament.
The Youth Enterprise Fund's model has increasingly become a popular strategic intervention to address the underlying socio-economic inequalities, lack of jobs, and exclusion of young people from economic governance processes.
70% of South Sudan's current population is youth, according to the United Nations. South Sudan's unemployment rate was reported to be 12.2% earlier this year, according to the World Bank. Chapter 4 of the peace agreement obliges the unity government to establish a youth enterprise development fund with a goal to bring more youth into economic growth and development. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, updates on the fight against COVID-19 in the United States. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you help someone dealing with depression?
I just give my time to that person and we discuss matter concerning that depression which that person is facing.
First of all, I'll find out what is depressing that person. And when I find out the root cause, of course, I try to advise the person according to what he or she is going through.
By counseling the person through counseling and then sharing ideas. Maybe sometimes going out for football or watching football, movies, such things can also help.
I recommend music, the music therapy. Music therapy in the sense that music has a way of giving a soothing feeling whenever the person listens to music.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
VOA always delivers your favorite programs, news, music, entertainment, and sports shows. Starting Monday, October 5th, our flagship news show, South Sudan in Focus, will be moving to 16:30 UTC, followed by your favorite sports show, The Sunny Side of Sports, at 1700 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. U.S. President Donald Trump has reversed his decision to hold off a new coronavirus stimulus until after the elections. Associate Press Correspondent Mike Gracia reports from Washington.
Hours after shutting down talks with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on additional COVID-19 relief until after the election, President Donald Trump backtracked. Trump took to Twitter Tuesday night and called for Congress to send him a standalone bill for stimulus checks. Trump tweeted, "I am ready to sign right now. Are you listening, Nancy?" The president also called on Congress to immediately approve $25 billion for airlines and $135 billion for the Paycheck Protection Program to help small businesses. Earlier Tuesday, Trump had tweeted that Pelosi was not negotiating in good faith, and he asked Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to focus on confirming Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Africa's response to COVID-19 has gained global recognition for its fast and targeted response to the virus. The Africa CDC has helped direct the continent's 54 countries into a well-oiled alliance, praised for responding better than some richer countries, including the United States. Africa has registered 35,440 deaths since the first case was announced, compared to more than 205,000 in the United States. Health experts weigh on what's behind the response, as Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
In late February, after Egypt confirmed Africa's first COVID-19 cases, John Nkangasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control, called a high-level meeting of health ministers. More than 40 ministers from around the continent scrambled to Addis Ababa on February 22nd. Nigeria's health minister, Osagie Ehanire, even changed his schedule while on a trip to Europe to be present. Within days, Nkangasong tells VOA in an interview, Africa CDC had produced the Africa Joint Continental Strategy for COVID-19, a blueprint to coordinate government action to combat the coronavirus. Zimbabwe, which had not yet confirmed its first case, preemptively implemented a full state of emergency that restricted flights and large gatherings. In South Africa, a lockdown was implemented on March 27 before even 1,000 COVID-19 cases had been recorded. Nkangasong says case numbers in places like South Africa could have been more than twice as high if such drastic action hadn't been taken.
That momentum that we had developed in Addis Ababa became the galvanizing force for countries to do what we have agreed on. COVID-19 crisis has exposed the divisions that exist in the world but also exposed the unity, okay, on the continent. I think the continent has come together more than I've ever seen in my 30 years of public health practice.
While Nkangasong says factors such as climate conditions, the average age of citizens, genetics and antibodies from pre-existing infections may have led to a lower number of deaths, the sense of urgency back in February also contributed. In June, the Africa CDC launched a joint procurement platform so governments can get protective personal equipment and other medical supplies. A testing campaign has resulted in more than 15 million tests being conducted across the continent to date. Nkangasong said that South Africa, which holds the rotating presidency of the African Union, convenes talks between heads of state and the Africa CDC once a month, and a campaign has recently been designed to coordinate how people in Africa travel through airports.
Put in more than 10,000 community healthcare workers, over 200 responders, that is epidemiologists, infection control people across multiple countries there. So I think for Africa, we've done the best with the limited resources that we have.
Emmanuel Agogo, country representative for Resolve to Save Lives, A team of global health experts aiding governments on their COVID-19 strategies said in an interview that the reason for fewer deaths in Africa remained a mystery. But, he said, a younger demographic, the fact many of the first cases were constrained to wealthier people entering the continent via plane, and the high number of people using antiviral medicine could all have contributed. Agogo says a World Health Organization initiative of joint external evaluations, which helps countries to prevent, detect and respond to public health risks, bolstered the ability of governments to act quickly.
By doing that, they actually knew where the furniture was, so they knew the gaps in their preparedness, and they all developed national plans.
Agogo said that countries in Africa deserved kudos for implementing safety measures despite the economic fallout from doing so, and the Africa CDC had learned much from coordinating responses with the likes of Ebola in Congo and Lassa fever in Nigeria. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The vice presidential debate comes a week after the first presidential debate. Tonight, Vice President Mike Pence and Joe Biden's running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, will meet to debate on a wide range of issues. VOA's Steve Reddish examines how the debate between the two running mates affects the election.
It is considered the political undercard, the vice presidential debate.
I think vice presidential debates often are more interesting to watch. The stakes are lower. The participants feel a little freer to say and do what they want.
Wednesday's debate between Republican Vice President Mike Pence and Democratic Senator Kamala Harris has multiple storylines that make it more interesting and watchable.
The historic nature of Kamala Harris's nomination and the fact that a woman of color, first woman of color on a major party ticket, will be debating.
Geraldine Ferraro was the first woman to participate in a vice presidential debate, facing George Herbert Walker Bush, Ronald Reagan's running mate, in 1984.
So I remember there being tremendous concern about the way Vice President Bush should debate the first female on a presidential ticket. And he could be at times a very competitive man and certainly was a very good debater, knew his material very well, but didn't want to look as though he was bullying her in any way.
In 2008, voters were eager to see Sarah Palin debate Joe Biden.
The expectations for that Biden-Palin vice presidential debate were so great. It's the only time in presidential debate history that the vice presidential debate outdrew, had more viewers than the top of the ticket presidential debates. And those top of the ticket debates were not snoozers because they included Barack Obama in terms of historic debates.
Now, President Trump's COVID diagnosis is increasing already high expectations for the Pence-Harris debate.
Vice President Pence was the head of the coronavirus task force. Originally, Trump seemed to sort of take it over from him. But certainly the Harris campaign will be going right for Pence on coronavirus concerns and talk about all the things that they think he did to not handle this as well as he could have.
Mary Kate Carey is a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center.
She's got a reputation for being a very aggressive questioner in the Senate Judiciary Committee. She's known for sort of laying these traps and trying to bait people to respond. So she will be a very formidable debater, I think. Pence, on the other hand, is a pretty unflappable guy, to the point of sometimes not being very animated at all. The chances of him falling into any sort of trap are pretty small. But I also think he's got an audience of one.
His illness aside, President Trump is age 74. Joe Biden is 77. This vice presidential debate has future implications.
If Mike Pence has another good debate in 2020, as he did 4 years ago, then that really helps strengthen his position as the Republican nominee in 2024. And the same with Kamala Harris, who's obviously, you know, young enough to have a long-term ambition here.
But too much focus on 4 years from now risks losing sight of the main debate objective: defend the presidential candidate they are running with.
I think that we'll see, again, Kamala Harris prosecuting why the Trump should not be returned to office, and then Pence having to defend the record for the past 4 years. And so that will be, I think, an interesting debate to watch.
The vice presidential candidates meet Wednesday evening in Salt Lake City, Utah. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Modou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa. This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Modou. The World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say we all can help fight the coronavirus pandemic by wearing face masks that cover our mouths and noses when we are in crowded areas. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest news on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
VOA always delivers your favorite programs, news, music, entertainment, and sports shows. Starting Monday, October 5th, our flagship news show, South Sudan in Focus, will be moving to 16:30 UTC, followed by your favorite sports show, The Sunny Side of Sports, at 1700 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Before we end this show, I have a special announcement for you. This program can now be heard in South Sudan at 7:30 p.m. local time on VOA affiliate stations. Please inform your friends and relatives. That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Kulu Kulu. We've been listening to this song entitled Kulu Kulu. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you leave your home. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. My brother, you are snake. We tell you that.